In this week's analysis, Chris Bowlby asks if the euro can survive the current crisis.
It was a wonderful party while it lasted. The European single currency launched with music and fireworks in 2002. All kinds of countries signed up. No one checked creditworthiness too carefully. Shiny new money, lots of it, was lent, spent and borrowed with optimistic abandon. Richer members found new friends to sell to. Poorer members in the so-called Eurozone believed they could suddenly afford a much better life. But then came the global economic crisis. Suddenly, everyone's lost confidence. Some fear bankruptcy. All are reading the small print. A furious argument erupted about who's going to pay the bills and whether the euro currency club, meant as a pillar of European unification, can survive at all.
I still do hope that the elites, but not only the elites, also population in all countries, will get the seriousness of the crisis, because the one thing which is not discussed is really sort of how we are going to live if the whole thing breaks up.
And if the Eurozone does avoid breakup, it's going to become a very different kind of club, with weaker members facing a crushing loss of political independence.
Any bailout will be accompanied by very serious conditions, and the men in suits will just simply tell us what has to be done.
And just in case you're a British listener thinking, we're not in the euro, so why do we care? Think again.
If we head into the sort of crisis we describe, obviously the shockwaves of that would be enormous, not just for the Eurozone, for the whole of the EU, and therefore for us, and I think for the global economy as well.
So why is the euro crisis so acute? Britain may not have realised its implications because it emerged in May, when we were preoccupied with our general election. Over in the Eurozone, there began a compelling drama, combining high finance, acute political rivalry, and, on the part of the leading players, sheer terror. The Greeks had been teetering on the edge of bankruptcy for weeks, while European leaders dithered. But it suddenly became clear that if Greece in effect went bust and the rest of the Euro club did nothing, the economic and political cost could be devastating.
This would have led to a banking panic.
Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator of the Financial Times.
There would have been large losses in banks, and they would have withdrawn their money, the core European financial institutions, from all the peripheral countries, and that would have then led to further difficulties in financing themselves for other countries like Spain, and that would then lead to a chain of state bankruptcies, and that would have then had a very large effect on the banking systems. Governments might have fallen in the process, and that was certainly sufficient, I think, to concentrate the minds.
The original thinking went like this. Economic and Monetary Union, or EMU, with the single currency its centrepiece, was supposed to offer its members at least some defence against the market speculators. Instead of countries and their national currencies being targeted one by one, a bigger union backed by a powerful new European central bank would have the cash and the credibility to keep everything more or less stable. And for a few years it seemed to work. But then the global crisis unleashed a much more hostile and unpredictable market mood, and the politicians were left bewildered. David Marsh, banker and author of a book on the euro.
The markets are very fickle. They're very happy to lend money under conditions which seem slightly absurd for long periods of time. And then they're like a herd of cattle. They suddenly go into the feeling that this is now unstable, and so they move off in a completely different direction. And the politicians always have difficulty in comprehending these mood swings, and they never recognise the signals of why the cattle go off in one direction rather than the other. And they tend to blame the cattle for behaving irrationally, when in fact the cattle are irrational.
In this case, the market stampeded in the belief that Greece would be unable to pay its debts and might be abandoned by the rest of the Eurozone. If that happened, which struggling banks or Euro members might be next? European leaders appeared paralysed, but they did finally act in May, prompted partly by a phone call to the German Chancellor Angela Merkel by American President Barack Obama, warning that the global economy was in jeopardy. A special fund was cobbled together by the European Union with help from the International Monetary Fund to bail out Greece and provide a war chest to prevent future crises. One of the places at the centre of the Eurozone crisis is here in Frankfurt, home of the European Central Bank. and its top officials have been under real pressure in recent weeks in the bank's headquarters, the Euro Tower, a gleaming skyscraper just ahead of me. Up until now, the people running the euro have generally preferred, like central bankers everywhere, to keep well out of any public debate. But a member of the bank's executive board, Lorenzo Binismaghi, has agreed to talk to me about how the bank's been responding to the crisis.
We are facing the biggest crisis since World War II. I think nobody could foresee that. I think all frameworks are being tested, be they surveillance of member states, regulatory systems, supervisory structures. All our structures in our societies and economies are being tested. This is one of the issues, and I think the fact that we are tackling it right away shows that Europe is reacting rather swiftly to these failures.
Swift or not, is the European response enough? Many warn that it's merely bought the eurozone some time. If fiscal crisis and low growth persists, not only in Greece but in other countries such as Spain, the potential bills balloon. For the really frightening lesson of the last few weeks for richer eurozone countries is what looks like unlimited liability. A currency supposed to unite its members in prosperity now has them jointly staring into a bottomless pit of debt. Daniel Gross, director of the Centre for European Policy Studies in Brussels, is a key figure in the debate.
Economies are moving in a different direction, but we have financial markets which are very much integrated. And that means that if we have a problem in Spain or in Greece, it spills over.
And isn't the fact that everything is now so integrated, and the single currency has helped with that, isn't that actually very frightening to people in a crisis, because the better off countries think we're liable for, it looks like, unlimited amounts of money if we have to be responsible for everything that happens anywhere in the eurozone?
Yes, that is the problem that Germany is facing. They would like to be able to say no, but they can't.
Greece was a relatively small problem, but if the problems grow in countries like Spain, much larger countries, then there's going to be a continuous sense of crisis, isn't there?
Exactly. And for Spain, the banking problem might be so large that the 440 billion are not enough, because the Spanish banking sector alone is much bigger than that figure. So the key thing is, can we find out how much will be the losses in Spain? Will it be 50 billion or 500? At present, nobody knows.
And if nobody has any real idea of the final bill, this begins to look like a trap, prompting some to start a frantic search for the exit. One man who could help is David Lassels from the free market think tank, the Centre for the Study of Financial Innovation. In the mid-1990s, he wrote a report, termed a fairy tale, imagining the future collapse of the single currency. It was only a story, but some of the scenario will look frighteningly familiar to eurozone members today. Back in the optimistic 1990s, however, pro-Europeans were deeply unimpressed.
To have an opposite view was almost treated as heresy. And when we published this particular paper, we were subjected not only to criticism, but to a lot of vilification as well by the pro-European forces.
What sort of thing did they say?
Well, they were rude to us, they insulted us, they cold-shouldered us. We made a presentation in Brussels where no one spoke to us.
But the idea, as far as they were concerned, it wasn't even worth discussing the possibility that this would eventually end in a breakup.
Clearly, people were aware that breakup was one of the dangers, but also one of their concerns was to suppress any discussion of that, because to do so would obviously damage the whole process. So there was a kind of orthodox religion.
A religion which Ulrike Gero knows well. She's now head of the Berlin office of the European Council on Foreign Relations, but has also worked in a think tank with Jacques Delors, who, as president of the European Commission, was one of the architects of economic and monetary union from the early 1990s. Potential problems, she admits, were always apparent, even to the faithful.
We knew at the very beginning that there were flaws of the institutional system of the euro. We knew that we had no sort of really fiscal unity in the system. And we knew it all. We could just sort of work around for 18 years. And now the financial crisis brought it up to daylight. And this is why we need now to discuss the fundamentals of the euro again.
Listening to this astonishing admission, you realise there was no proper debate about how the euro would work, especially in a crisis. For leaders like Helmut Kohl or François Mitterrand back in the 1990s, European Union was a matter of destiny, never mind the detail. Discussions about the euro's future today still echo this feeling. The idea of expelling countries from EMU, or even allowing countries to leave it, shocks those weaned on the idea of a European Union ever closer, ever larger. So there's likely to be precious little said about the possibility in public. Martin Wolf.
It would be thought of as the discussion of the unthinkable. And I'm sure that the fear would be if people know that we are discussing the unthinkable, then the unthinkable becomes less unthinkable. And the more thinkable it becomes, the more possible processes can then begin to be, which actually make it more likely. It should be stressed, however, that within the European Union treaties, as they are now, and they're not going to change them in the near future, there is no mechanism. So it would be an legal nightmare if actually they did start thinking about how to get rid of countries.
Unravelling Euro membership would provide hours of employment for lawyers and Eurocrats. A country can always decide to issue its own money again. Who knows, perhaps some hopeful printers are even now dusting off old templates for drachmas or pesetas. But new notes and coins would, in a way, be the easy bit. If you have a new currency, but all your existing domestic and international contracts are drawn up in euros, who decides which currency value prevails? David Lassels believes Europe's policymakers are thinking about this more than they'll admit.
They must have been doing a huge amount of internal research to work out the issues. In fact, they would be very foolish if they hadn't been doing that. But there is a strong outward position, which is that none of this is relevant because it's not going to happen, and that's the line they're trying to hold.
But do you think there would be a lot of discussion, both among their policymakers and more widely in financial circles, that you need to have some kind of procedure for this scenario if it's not to be completely chaotic?
Absolutely. I think an exit route is something that the euro has got to have. When they set it up, they shut the exit doors because they wanted to make this a permanent and credible venture. It's proved not to be the case, and therefore, to relieve that pressure, you've got to have an orderly way out, and I think that's a very high priority at the moment.
The financial maestros who reside many floors up in the Frankfurt Euro Tower would, until recently, have dismissed the idea of a country leaving the euro as not worth a moment's discussion. No longer.
I think it is an idea that people are talking, and it's an easy reaction. Why doesn't Greece get out of the euro? It's very instinctive. Why should we pay for Greece?
Why should we pay for Greece? An opinion easy to find in several Eurozone countries. When I visited top European Central Bank official Lorenzo Binismaghi last month, he acknowledged that debate about a Eurozone breakup appears to be growing. But he hopes to stop such ideas in their tracks by pointing out the consequences.
If you think it through, it is a scenario which is a nightmare. Getting out of a single currency is not like devaluing the exchange rate. It entails recontracting all the contracts, financial contracts, everything. It would be devastating for a country, and I think it's much better in the end to stick by the rules.
You mentioned rules and discipline. A lot of people would say now the logical conclusion of having stricter rules is you have to have a mechanism for punishing people who don't follow the rules, which might lead in the end to suspension or even expulsion from the Eurozone. Is that a possibility now?
Well, I think we need to create sanctions which are credible, which countries implement in maybe in a gradual way and become more and more strict. I think the expulsion is not a credible threat in the end, because this in the end is partly a political process of integration.
A political process. This is the moment when you grasp an essential truth about the euro, easily forgotten amidst all the talk of debt levels or financial markets. The single currency is meant to be, at root, a political project, a unifier of Europe, a badge of belonging to a continent growing ever closer. So, however dire the economic numbers may look, expulsion from the single currency club would stand for much more than just an economic setback. It would send the whole European unity train into reverse. Policymakers are searching for ways of enforcing Eurozone discipline without having to threaten expulsion, but it's a hard balance to strike. Daniel Gross is experimenting with a new metaphor for the single currency club.
Imagine a tennis club and one member violates the rules. What do? Basically tell him, okay, you don't play anymore with us. If you sense you're not thrown out of the club, but we don't play anymore with you. And that's what would happen if a country were to default. It would be basically cut off from the ECB's monetary policy operations. It would still be in the Eurozone, but it would also be on its own.
But people would say it doesn't make sense to be part of the Eurozone if you're cut off from all these fundamental aspects, such as the European Central Bank.
That is true. And actually, as you can imagine, if you are the wild boy in a tennis club and you don't obey the rules and you are being cut off from playing with the others, you might as well throw the door closed and say, okay, I'm going away. I'm no longer part of this club at all. But that's then your decision. That's different from being thrown out. And that is a very important distinction which would also operate in this case. If Greece were to default, it would be excluded from much of the benefits of the Eurozone. But the decision whether actually to leave formally the Eurozone or not would be Greece's and Greece's alone.
There is, of course, another scenario which people talk about, which is that a country like Germany might decide that being in the Eurozone is no longer in its interest and it might decide to leave.
Yeah, but you see, the best player doesn't want to leave a club because with whom can he play then?
But Germany is no longer the best and most enthusiastic European player it once was. It's in a defensive mood, worried about globalisation and its ageing population. It's also looking increasingly in other directions, forging special relationships with China and Russia, no longer so directly focused on the EU. It feels too that its economic development as an efficient exporting nation is set on a very different course than many of its Eurozone partners. And when it comes to the euro and the politics of money, there's always a uniquely German angst, which I discussed with the co-publisher of Germany's most prestigious newspaper, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. We're sitting here in Frankfurt, the home of the European Central Bank. Germans have a long history of worrying intensely about the value of their money, long historical memories about currency crises. Are they worrying about the euro in that way?
They do.
Bertolt Kohler.
As you mentioned, the history, it was a big national trauma was the hyperinflation after World War I, where basically everyone lost their savings and their possessions. So the history of the German mark was a success story after World War II, and people were not really much in favor of giving up this currency after European integration came along. So the promise of the politicians was that the euro will be as stable and strong as the German mark was, and while there is a rising doubt that this promise will be kept.
And nostalgia for the Deutschmark, symbol of Germany's post-war economic miracle, is thriving. The most bizarre place I found it was in the souvenir shop on the ground floor of the European Central Bank's Frankfurt headquarters. On sale, gold-plated mementos of the old mark with a sentimental inscription, "Du warst uns Gold wert," you were worth gold to us. For those with such happy memories of the mark, the euro looks an increasingly dodgy replacement. The ECB, too, seems nothing like the utterly reliable old Bundesbank, which never did anything remotely risky. If experts like Daniel Gross are right about how the European Bank plans to defend the euro against speculators, that German angst will only grow.
The ECB basically has an unlimited backstop. It can print as much money as it wants to, and I don't think any hedge fund would speculate against that kind of organization.
But the idea of the ECB, the European Central Bank, printing as much money as it wants to, that's surely something that's going to be horrific to some people in the Eurozone, notably Germany.
Exactly, and I must admit, I don't like the idea either.
But even if it never has to resort to mass money printing, what the ECB's already done to tackle the Greek debt crisis has alarmed many Germans. Buying up bonds, classified as junk, touches, says David Marsh, a very sensitive historical nerve.
This happened after the First World War. This certainly happened under Hitler, when the central bank starts to buy up government securities. And this is the one thing the Germans always said they weren't going to do, and now they are doing it through the ECB. And they are purchasing bonds which are officially declared as junk bonds. The Greek bonds have been said by all the credit rating agencies to be junk. And yet the European Central Bank, which is supposed to be the reincarnation of the Bundesbank, is buying up Greek securities. And that, for the Germans, is almost like the death knell of the euro.
So where might this all lead? Some believe Germany could eventually leave the single currency and form a smaller club of countries sharing its economic approach. There could be a northern version of the euro, dubbed the Neuro, worrying for those neurotic about assertive Germans. That seems highly unlikely for now. But what Germany will insist on is much tougher enforcement of rules designed to stop euro members running up debt. It's a chilling prospect for weaker economies. On a recent visit to Dublin, I heard the former governor of the Bank of Ireland, Lawrence Crowley, wondering whether his financially beleaguered country would be refused a bailout in this new, much stricter euro world.
You can't abandon a member of your family and expect that member of the family to be loyal to you for the rest of their lives. No, it would be regarded as a very anti-European event.
But you're a banker, you will have international experience. Can you understand the debate now going on, say, in Berlin and elsewhere? If we bail them out this time, the same thing's going to happen in a few years' time.
I think that's important. And I understand what the Germans are talking about. It's very plausible. They have, of course, been bailing out bits of Europe forever, because they've always been the strongest member. But I believe that any bailout will be accompanied by very serious conditions. And the men in suits will just simply tell us what has to be done.
Men in suits taking over brings back memories of when Britain was bailed out by the IMF in the 1970s. But this would be a much more profound and permanent challenge to national control of economic policy. We're back to that tension at the heart of all the Eurozone's problems, trying to run a common monetary policy without a political union. After this traumatic crisis, fearful of renewed monetary meltdown, the single currency's most powerful players will now insist that individual countries deemed fiscally irresponsible surrender much of their economic freedom. Other forms of discipline, suggests Martin Wolf, just won't work.
Sanctions, you know, the sort of imposing taxes on people who misbehave is not going to work. If a country is in desperate plight, insisting that it pay a huge fine is sort of pointless, since they would have to borrow the money from the countries that the other countries in order to pay their own fines, if they can't borrow the money. So it's an absurd idea to impose a huge fine. So you have these two alternatives. You expel countries or you take them over. And then the question is, who's accountable?
What a choice. Chuck countries out or force them to leave, watch them face huge legal wrangles and struggle to fund any kind of economic recovery. Or keep them in, but take over their economic policy, undermining the EU's claim to be a family of independent democracies. But business as usual for the Eurozone is not an option. For those guiding the single currency project, like Lorenzo Bini-Smaghi at the European Central Bank, the point is to be open about the political demands the euro makes, even if its members didn't know what they were signing up for.
Well, they didn't realize how deep the interactions with other countries that result out of sharing the same currency, actually how deep political links would also emerge. In the end, if the failure of your neighbor creates problem for you, it's not only an economic problem, it's a political issue, because it affects your own interests, and then you have an incentive to try to help him out or help him help himself, if you want. So it is a political union.
But the argument was often made that you couldn't have a successful economic and monetary union until you had a political union first. You're saying that the economic and monetary union is driving ahead the political union.
Well, or yes, driving ahead, or to some extent it entails political links. I mean, economic links, to the extent that they affect people, they affect citizens' life, are political issues.
Eurozone policymakers are comforting themselves by remembering that previous leaps forward in integration have often followed times of crisis. But the hope for a decisive shift towards greater political union hardly fits the current mood of European public opinion. And the old idea that European Union guarantees peace and prosperity no longer has its strong post-war appeal. Ulrike Gero of the European Council on Foreign Relations.
You have a right-wing populism throughout the European Union, East and West. You have regional claims. We do have, honestly, a problem with the European idea per se. And we do have that problem in all domestic countries. So this is a fact. The question is, how do we handle this? Are we still altogether still convinced that there's a project at stake that makes us all better live and all richer and all more prosper and all more peaceful? If we can't say yes to this question, then something may happen.
Imagine how easily populists could exploit German-driven austerity imposed on their countries as unemployment and social unrest rises. There's also major disagreement between the two most powerful countries, Germany and France, on which economic policy all Eurozone members should now follow. German insistence on austerity and sound money is challenged by a French desire for a more expansionist approach. What's more, says Martin Wolf, these two key countries are increasingly reluctant to bury their differences in the name of European cooperation.
the general tendency, particularly in core countries, above all in Germany and France, although they're the key things, has, in my perception, been to become less European, less attached to the project, less rooted in the deep political motivations of the project. I mean, I think normal nationalism has become more powerful. Politics and political leaders have become more inward-looking and nationalistic. And that makes the great leap forward, which people had hoped for in such a crisis, obviously much more difficult. I mean, in some deep way, they're all becoming a little bit more British.
Who knows? France and Germany might even give up the euro and try to join sterling. This might all be music to the ears of observers like David Lassels, who foresaw that the eurozone might break up many years ago. But he doesn't see the idea of a common currency or even political union as flawed in itself. What was needed to avoid today's crisis was much better political preparation.
I've always viewed the euro as essentially the final piece in the jigsaw rather than the first piece, or, using another metaphor, the keystone that you drop in at the top of the arch once all the other pieces have been put in place. The architects of the euro saw it in a very different way, as being one of the drivers behind unification. We see it as the final sort of crowning achievement, and I think that that's still possible, but now it's a very long way down the road.
So, will the euro survive?
I don't think there will be a single currency for Europe in a decade.
David Marsh.
I think there's going to be a breakup between the North and the South. And so the party in 20 years after the setup of the euro will be a rather subdued affair. And I think we will be looking back at this as a message that economics always triumphs over politics, and the hard facts of money are the supreme arbiter of great currency schemes.
From high up in the European Central Bank's skyscraper headquarters overlooking Frankfurt, Italian financial expert Lorenzo Benismaghi surveys the future. He's sure the euro will survive, even when I test him with a euro version of the $6 million question.
So you haven't held on to a few million lira just in case you need them again in the future?
Not at all.
The Eurotrain set off on its adventure nearly a decade ago. After years of good times when the wheels could be oiled with a flow of easy new money, today's hard times leave the eurozone fractious and fearful of how the final bill will be split. Some member states might just decide that in the end they want their own money back, a hazardous step in itself, but one that may be increasingly tempting. For now, as members of the single currency struggle to keep the train on track, they're ready for an almighty political battle over who really controls their cash.